Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. This is Siegfried, and I want to talk about, or at least discuss, Palestine, Gaza today. I don't think this will come as any surprise to my listeners, but I mean I've covered this so many times. I've covered the in 2014. Back in the USSR, we talked about how when the last time Israel went into Gaza in a ground invasion and blanketed the neighborhood of Shejaiya with 155 millimeter shells, killed hundreds of civilians. We've covered many times just like the constant bombings and attacks that the Israeli occupation forces have waged upon the Palestinians trying to resist that occupation. In this area of the world characterized by apartheid and forced dispossession of the indigenous inhabitants by a colonial force, by a colonial power backed by the United States. We've also talked about the Great March of Return in 2018 when Palestinians marched peacefully in Gaza to demand their rights. And they were met by Israeli snipers. And hundreds of them were killed or injured. And now, you know, we see things, they've reached a crescendo, if you will. And I feel rather ill-equipped to describe what is going on. So I'm gonna turn it over to some commentators who are much more able than myself to describe what is going on right now. And that is Vijay Prashad and Zoe Alexandra of People's Dispatch. This was the broadcast that they gave about the situation in Gaza on October 20th. So please listen to what they have to say. And it's just one of the best overviews I could find. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
People's Dispatch and Globetrotter were a special segment on the conflict taking place in Gaza. It's important before we get into it to recognize that this particular conflict didn't start on October 7th. This is not about Gaza versus Israel. This is not even merely about the Palestinians versus Israel. This is a broader, much more difficult topic to cover in the brief time we have here. It's a conflict that goes back about at least 90 years when Palestinian Christians and Palestinian Muslims began to be expelled from the region of the Levant, both Palestine but other parts of what was then in the former Ottoman Empire, now controlled by the British. Very difficult 90 years. In fact, more than from 1948, 90 years of difficulty for the Palestinian Christians and Muslims expelled or massacred in their homelands as Europe decided to outsource its anti-Semitist attitudes against European Jews into this region, creating a very difficult situation. One has often heard the word intractable used to describe it. Punctually, since at least 1948, there have been attacks by the Israeli military, Israeli settlers, against Palestinian Christians and Muslims who have had to flee further and further from their homes since the Nakba, the catastrophe of 1948, fleeing further and further from their homes. And then in 1967, in the Naksa, other big war, coming under occupation directly. War, occupation, dispossession. This has marked this region for 90 years. And then on October 7th, the Palestinians once more trying to stand up and say we exist, having been on a punctual basis, not only forgotten, but their oppression allowed to continue without any respite. You got to keep in mind that this particular uprising of the Palestinians, quite remarkable in one way, this particular uprising of the Palestinians took place as a consequence of the so-called Abraham Accords put in place by former U.S. President Donald Trump, normalizing relations between Israel and its neighbors, moving for the full expulsion of the Palestinians from their land. It also comes at a time when important members of Benjamin Netanyahu's government, including his Minister of Finance, have been saying things this year, such as, there is no such thing as a Palestinian, there is no Palestine. This kind of attitude rekindled the idea of resistance. That resistance took place quite remarkably. And then this bombardment, which has been going on now for 2 weeks. Zoe, this bombardment has had a terrible impact on Palestine. Why don't you give us some of the numbers, some of the reporting coming in from Gaza, one enclave of many of the Palestinian people, the occupied Palestinian territory, which includes East Jerusalem, the West Bank, and Gaza. This particular conflict in Gaza, although the West Bank and East Jerusalem under lockdown, people being killed there as well. Not in the news so much, but there are settlers attacking Palestinians during this lockdown. But give us a sense of the numbers and the reporting of what's coming out of Gaza.
Well, it is hard to put a number on such immense human suffering and this humanitarian disaster. Some are calling it a genocide that has been unfolding for the past 2 weeks. So I'll try to give a bit of an update regarding numbers, but also knowing that this will never really encapsulate really what is going on the ground and the grief and the pain that people are feeling. But since October 7th, Israel began this bombing campaign, which, as you pointed out, has been quite punctual against Gaza for the past 16 years. Gaza has every three or four years has suffered from these bombing campaigns. But this one, of course, was in response to a quite successful and, as many pointed out, surprise operation from the resistance. And so there's been this sort of vengeance, this sort of unbridled anger against the people of Gaza, kind of no holds barred with these attacks. And we've seen that this is evident in, for example, the types of buildings that have been bombed, the type of disregard really for the civilian population. And so right now we're looking at over 4,500 people in Gaza that have been registered dead. But as we know, these bombings have been taking place in large civilian infrastructure, tall buildings, hospitals, churches, schools. And so there's, I think, about over 10,000 people have been injured. And so, unfortunately, we're looking at that death toll to likely rise in coming days, both in terms of people who've been injured and who might perish, for example, in the hospitals that don't have enough supplies, but also in the people who are currently missing. And at the same time, as you mentioned, this assault on the Palestinian people is not just happening within the enclave, within the Gaza Strip, but also within historic Palestine, the State of Israel. There are retaliation attacks. Hundreds of people have been arrested. And then within West Bank itself, in response to protests, but also just randomly, there have been a couple dozen people who have been killed within the West Bank, which adds this number. And there was a report today stating that the number of prisoners, of Palestinian prisoners being held in Israeli prisons, has doubled since October 7th. And that we know that one of the major demands of resistance groups over the past 2 weeks has been the immediate release of the, what before the operation, 5,000 Palestinian prisoners. Now that number is at 10,000. This has been a key demand. And prisoner exchanges and prisoner swaps have been a characteristic of kind of how the dynamic between Israel and the resistance groups has taken place. We know that there was a really infamous or famous prisoner swap, which was Gilad Shalit, which was one Israeli soldier for about 5,000 Palestinian prisoners. This was really crucial, and there was an expectation that during this moment, something similar could take place. But we have seen that from the Israeli side, there's been almost no opening to this. And especially now with the number of prisoners that have been taken, unsure if this path is going to be the one that moves forward. But yeah, just to say again, hospitals, schools, civilian buildings, residential buildings, offices of aid agencies, news agencies, these have been the primary targets in the bombings for over the past 2 weeks.
17 United Nations aid officials among the etching up to 5,000 dead in Gaza. A conference held in Cairo about getting emergency aid. Now, let's put this emergency aid by truck through the Rafah crossing between Egypt and Gaza into context. Before this particular bombing began, it took 450 trucks a day crossing that border to feed, clothe, get energy into Gaza. 450 trucks a day to feed the almost 2 million people that live in Gaza, half of them children. It's very important to put this number out there because right now, 20 trucks have been allowed to cross from Egypt into Gaza. 20 trucks. 9 of them from the United Nations, 11 of them from the Egyptian Red Cross. I just want people to keep thinking about that number. It takes 450 trucks to supply Gaza at a minimal, and the world has only allowed 20 trucks to cross. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said all of this must end. Not sure what he means by end, Zoe, and we'll come back to that. What is the end of this? 700,000 people from Gaza have fled the north for South Gaza. The Israelis callously have said that whatever aid comes in, and look, these 20 trucks at maximum, at starvation levels, can provide food for a week for 40,000 people. 40,000 people could get food stretched at barely above starvation food levels. 700,000 people have moved from the north to the south as a consequence of the bombing and so on. And even that, roads are being attacked by the Israelis, cutting off the ability of buses to go south and so on. People are starving. There is no end game here. What the real end game from the Israelis is, and it's very clear, is to have the Palestinian population go into Egypt and disappear. And then Israel can convert the coastline of Gaza into some sort of paradise. That's what they really want to do, is to remove all the Palestinians from Gaza, just as the end game in the West Bank is annexation. Annex the West Bank, move the Palestinians to Jordan, to Lebanon, and so on. I've often said, from the Israeli point of view, a long time ago, they've given up on the two-state solution. That is to say, the establishment of a Palestinian state in the occupied Palestinian territory of East Jerusalem, West Bank, and Gaza. They've given up on that. The Israeli government is in favor of a three-state solution, which is Egypt, Jordan, and Lebanon. They want to remove the Palestinians from what they call Greater Israel, send them off all into exile, and then create a homogeneous Jewish state. That is the explicit, almost explicit, near explicit policy of the Israeli government, articulated over and over again by government ministers and laws. Annexationism through the settlement policy in the West Bank is pretty clear. The best land, the best water, military running up and down Highway 90, named after that notorious annexationist, the minister Zivi, who was assassinated in 2001 by the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Why I'm talking about this starving of the people of Gaza is it's never been a policy of the Israelis to make a peace agreement with the Palestinians. It's always been a policy to get the Palestinians out of there and claim all that land. That's basically what they've been going through. And interestingly, I'm going to get to this issue of peace deals, ceasefires, and so on in a minute, Zoe. But interestingly, Huffington Post released a very interesting set of notifications. They've got a story up called "Stunning State Department Memo Warns Diplomats, No Gaza De-escalation Talk." I found this very interesting. Specifically, three phrases are no longer to be used by the U.S. State Department, led by Antony Blinken in the government of President Joe Biden. One phrase, de-escalation ceasefire, not to be used. Second, end to violence and bloodshed, not to be used. And third, restoring calm, not to be used. That means the United States government has now got a policy not even to talk about an end to the bloodshed, a minimal demand in this time. U.S. policy is going to be, go for it. Go after the Palestinians, send them to Egypt, send them to Jordan, send them to Lebanon, end all talk of Palestinians, make Palestine disappear. That seems to be the policy, Zoe, not only of the government of national unity, both of Benjamin Netanyahu and Benny Gantz, but it seems to also be the policy of the Biden administration, which went there during the bombing of the hospital and then hook, line, and sinker accepted the Hasbara, the propaganda of the Israeli government, saying this is not an attack by an Israeli aircraft, but is a Islamic Jihad rocket went wrong. And by the way, they used Al Jazeera footage, live footage, to say, well, look, it's a Islamic Jihad rocket. Al Jazeera went back and reviewed the footage and showed that the Islamic Jihad rocket or somebody's rocket struck the Iron Dome and deteriorated. And seconds later, there was an airstrike on the hospital and a couple of other targets. So that the United States saying, well, look, the Israelis are right. This was not an Israeli attack on the Al-Ahir hospital, on the Al-Ahir Arab hospital, but it was an attack by Islamic Jihad, holds no water. The United States, shoulder to shoulder with the Israeli government, saying, allow for annexation, allow for the complete removal of the Palestinian population, a grotesque war crime. But others are calling for a ceasefire. Walk us through this talk of ceasefires.
Yes, well, there has been, as you said, the U.S. has maintained its position. And as you said, it's completely blocked any sort of discussion about anything other than complete support to Israel and condemnation of Gaza and just dehumanization of Palestinians. The U.S. and, of course, the EU, which has been right by its side with the same level of warmongering discourse, they're looking more and more isolated. And this, I would say, is definitely a shift from prior moments where maybe the U.S. was able to manipulate or have more control over Global South discourse and how they were expressing themselves in this moment. Of course, no, understanding that the Global South has historically been with Palestine, but we're seeing some new voices expressing support to Palestinians and denouncing the acts by Israel. One voice that has stood out is Gustavo Petro. And I think for many people, this has been a welcome voice in this discourse because, of course, Colombia, which had been historically termed South America's Israel because of its geostrategic importance for the United States, because of it serving as sort of this military outpost for the United States, mirroring the role of Israel in, of course, West Asia, of course, with its nuances, et cetera. But also, Colombia has had military cooperation with Israel. It's had a long history, actually, with Israel itself. And Gustavo Petro, in this moment, he has been one of the leading voices speaking out about Israeli crimes. And, of course, he's been met with a lot of backlash. He has been called an anti-Semite. He's been called someone who supports terrorism, all sorts of things. And instead of backtracking, like some politicians might do, say, oh, no, you know what, you're right, I support Israel, this is all horrible, Gustavo Petro has actually doubled down. And since the beginning of the Israeli bombing on Gaza, he's actually has really, really spoken out. He's spoken out about claims about anti-Semitism. He said, there's nothing anti-Semitic about being against the killing of children. I forgot to mention before, but there, the death toll of children within these bombings is over 1,500. And it's perhaps this sheer brutality and sheer, this level of killing of children that has mobilized many to really understand this is not, this is not such a complicated issue. We're talking about children being bombed, children being killed. And Gustavo Petro has really changed the discourse, at least in Latin America. I think he's been saying time and time again, this is about humanity, survival. This is about us standing up for our morals. We can't talk about being people who care about their neighbors. We can't talk about people who care about humanity if we're standing and watching an entire people being massacred, if we're watching children being killed like this. So Gustavo Petro has been sort of an internet warrior, refuting these claims, consistently sharing the reality of what's happening in Gaza on the ground. Other Latin American leaders, Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro has continued in the line of the Bolivarian Revolution and standing with Palestine. Venezuela has historically been a strong ally of the Palestinian people, not only receiving, standing up in international spaces for Palestine, but its school, the School of Latin American Medicine, has always received a couple hundred Palestinian students every year to train them as doctors so they can go back to Palestine and serve their people. So this is a long legacy of solidarity, and this was evident in the recent sending of humanitarian aid to the Rafah crossing, which again, there have been several shipments of humanitarian aid to this crossing, but as you said, a very, very, very small amount has been able to be let through. But again, this is a strong showing of solidarity, not only in the material sense, but also in the political sense, to really stand up to this blockade and say, we're going to support no matter what. So that, again, Venezuela standing with Palestine, Cuba as well has made quite strong statements on the international stage. And within the West Asian region, again, I think, as you were talking about before, this move towards normalization has definitely seen a setback. Of course, Saudi Arabia had not signed the agreement with the United States, with Israel, to recognize Israel before this happened. And I think that is going to look extremely, extremely difficult. I think the U.S. maybe miscalculated what would happen if Israel launched such an aggressive, aggressive attack on Palestine. Unclear if any of those agreements that had already been signed are in jeopardy, but it's definitely sure that those who are maybe on the fence about signing this definitely are going to be thinking again, if this is the right move, probably not. So we have seen that strong statements from those countries. You spoke about the call between Saudi Arabia and Iran that took place. These are important developments. And I just wanted to quickly edit a number that I had said before. The Gilad Shalit prisoner exchange was just 1,000 Palestinian prisoners who were exchanged for his release as a captive.
You know, when you talked about the normalization slowing down, if and when the land invasion starts and the numbers of Palestinian dead, the war crimes increase, there will be a lot of pressure on the King of Jordan, on President Sisi of Egypt, and so on, to reconsider their own peace agreements with the Israeli state. Already, the Jordanian king has said, Abdullah II has said, that he's heartsick by seeing the massacres of Palestinians in Gaza. Amnesty International's report on October 20th already calls on the fact that there are war crimes. They look at 5 incidents and they say, look, 5 incidents, not enough, but in these 5 incidents, credible war crime allegations, entire families wiped out, and so on. I would like to say every time Israel bombs Gaza with such ferocity, Amnesty releases reports saying war crimes have been committed. The International Criminal Court, which has opened an investigation into Israel's war crimes, just can't seem to advance the file. A lot of pressure coming on them from Washington, D.C. United States simply unwilling to allow anybody to talk about the language of war crimes when it comes to Israel. Yoav Gallant, the defense minister of Israel, went to a parliamentary committee on Friday, and he said this land war that is starting, which will follow the air war, is going to have 3 phases. And these 3 phases actually already suggest a war crime. The first phase, he says, is to knock out all Hamas infrastructure. Well, good luck with that. That's not going to be easy. As we've seen over the last 90 years, every time Israel feels that it's been able to obliterate resistance from the Palestinians, the resistance returns. The second is to dismantle all other factions' military capabilities, unlikely again, for the same reasons. Whether it's Hamas, whether it's Islamic Jihad, it doesn't matter. Some years ago, Khalid Mishal, who was then of Hamas's spokesperson, said that, look, if the West is worried about Hamas, they have no idea that amongst a restive and angry youth in Gaza in particular, they see Hamas as too moderate. They are getting attracted to much less moderate forces than Hamas. So something that both Tel Aviv and Washington should have listened to 10 years ago, when Khalid Mishal said this, but the dynamic starts much earlier. Yoav Gallant, Israeli defense minister's third point, is the really chilling one. He says that in the third phase of this land operation that is going to happen, he said in this third phase, what they are, quote, you know, looking forward to is a new security architecture. He basically said quite plainly that they're going to just get rid of the Palestinians from Gaza. I mean, there is no deep reading needed of what Yoav Gallant said. He basically said the third phase will require the removal of Israel's responsibility for life in the Gaza Strip and the establishment of a new security reality for the citizens of Israel. That's what he said. You read that, and you don't have to do, as I said, too much reading. That means the expulsion of Palestinians from Gaza, because effectively, It's not just Hamas. It's not just Islamic Jihad. It's not just the other factions. It's the Palestinian people. One of the reasons people tell me in Israel, one of the reasons that they feel that the Israeli government has hesitated before sending the tanks into the Gaza Strip is that they recognize that the Palestinians, not just the factions, civilians, are going to throw everything at those tanks. They're going to stand and fight. Why? Because their children are being butchered. They're not going to permit Israeli tanks to just roll in and create a quote-unquote new security architecture. They're going to fight on the ruined streets of Gaza, one little enclave after the next. They're going to throw bottles of olive oil at those tanks, throw anything, throw their bodies at those tanks. The Israelis understand that. They understand that this death toll, if the tanks roll in, can go to several tens of thousands because the Palestinians are not going to put up the white flag of surrender. That's why they're hesitating. But that's why also they're saying, we're going to just wipe the people off. They recognize this is not a problem of Hamas and the factions alone. The Palestinian people are going to resist because indeed they have a right to resist. So a lot of talk now, Zoe, about Israel's right to defend itself. The Palestinians actually have a statutory, a legal right to resist against occupation, a declared occupation. The UN calls Gaza part of the occupied Palestinian territories. Under international law, Palestinians have a right to resist. It's a legal right. It's not a moral right. It might also be a moral right, but it's a legal right. Israelis know that. They're hesitating. They don't want to enter into a cauldron. But in the few minutes we have left, tell us a little bit, Zoe, about not only what governments have been doing, but I have watched occasionally large demonstrations around the world.
Yeah, I think it's important to end on this note of hope, because it's hard to see everything that's happening, hard to see just the callousness of some of the global North leaders in regards to the situation. And it's very easy to get discouraged. It's very easy to feel that there's no hope. But I think that the example of the Palestinian people over these past 90 years in their steadfast resistance to this occupation and their continued hope and resilience, that has to be centered, and we have to carry that with us as well, because the Palestinian people have never stopped resisting. And I think that the international response to these war crimes that are taking place has also been quite inspiring and quite uplifting. Again, there have been bombing after bombing of Gaza, maybe back in the 2000s, just after Hamas won the elections, and we saw bombings in the end of that decade, we would have seen a couple thousand people on the street, maybe in just Washington, D.C., maybe in Paris, a couple thousand. Today, we're seeing tens of thousands of people, not just in capital cities, in towns and cities across the United States, across major European countries, across the African continent, across Asia. This is something that's truly inspiring. I mean, to see, for example, in New York City, which the mayor, Kathy Hochul, said that New York will always stand with Israel. And then the next day to see, again, over 10,000 people on the streets. That's truly remarkable. Again, in cities across Europe where it has been banned to even carry a Palestinian flag, where there's been a ban on people's right to protest, saying that you can't actually protest and stand in solidarity with Palestine. Still, thousands of people have said, no, nothing will stop our resistance, our solidarity with the Palestinian people. Nothing will silence us. And I think that's something that we have to continue. We have to continue reporting on what's happening with this solidarity, with people demanding better from their governments. The U.S., for example, yesterday approved billions of dollars in military aid to Israel. This is while millions of people are taken off healthcare, while millions of people are losing their welfare and other crucial social security safety nets. Yet the government decides that they're going to send more military aid to Israel, more military aid to Ukraine, to essentially sponsor massacres from happening. And people have stood up and said, not only are we against you taking our tax money for these things, for the military, for military companies, for the weapons contractors, which have seen a massive raise in their stock prices. But also, we will not allow you to massacre the Palestinian people, and we know that you have blood on our hands. So I think though that is continuing. The wave of solidarity is only rising. More people are taking to the streets. More actions are being organized. We know that on November 4th, there's an international call for solidarity mobilizations with Palestine, and that will definitely be tremendous.
Here is the morality of the West, Zoe. 20 trucks of aid allowed in to Gaza through the Rafah crossing. Meanwhile, hundreds of millions of dollars of weaponry being airshipped to Israel. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said, let this nightmare come to an end. He's right. The issue is, what nightmare is he referring to? The trucks not entering Palestine? Is that all he's talking about? The ceasefire of this conflict? Or is the nightmare something much greater than that? Is the nightmare the occupation, the dispossession, the war? Hopefully, the United Nations is not just talking about the trucks, although the trucks must get in. Hopefully, they're talking about the war, the dispossession, and the occupation. You've been listening to People's Dispatch with Zoe Alexandra and Vijay from Globetrotter, coming to you with a special report on the nightmare that is afflicting the Levant region, 90-year-old nightmare. Hopefully, we can get past it. Thanks a lot.
This is for Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for an answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine, long live Gaza. Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for an answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine. While we listen to tunes made by ignorant fools, Israel blocked the UN from delivering food. They bring in the troops and you won't even glimpse of the news. They make money off the products that we're quick to consume. And it's not simply a question of differing views. Forget emotions, this is facts, what I spit is the truth. Makes no difference if you're a Christian or if you're a Jew. They're just people living in different conditions to you. They still die when you bomb their schools, mosques and hospitals. It's not because of rockets, please God, can you stop this all? I'm not related to the strangers on the TV, but I relate, cause those strangers could have been me. Words could never ever explain the raw tragedy. It's not a war, they're just murdering more rapidly, and we are automatically supporting pure savagery. Imagine how you feel if this was your family. Sing it with me now. Free, free Palestine. 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 Palestine remains in my heart forever. We stand for peace, times of war, we shan't surrender. Remember, it didn't start in this dark December. Every coin is a bullet if you're Marks and Spencer. And when you're sipping Coca-Cola, that's another pistol in the holster of them soulless soldiers. You say you know about the Zionist lobby, but you put money in their pocket when you're buying their coffee. Talking about revolution sitting in Starbucks. The fact is, that's the type of thinking I can't trust, let alone even start to respect. Before you talk, learn the meaning of that scarf on your neck. Forget Nestle, Obama promised Israel 30 billion over the next decade. They're trigger happy and they're crazy. Think about that when you're putting Huggies nappies on your baby. Sing it with me now. Free, free Palestine. 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 This is not just a war over stolen land. Why do you think little boys are throwing stones at tanks? And we'll never really know how many people are dead. They drop bombs on innocent girls while they sleep in their bed. Don't get offended by facts, just try and listen. Nothing is more anti-Semitic than Zionism. So please don't bring bad vibes when you speak to me. There's plenty of rabbis that agree with me. It's your choice what you do with this message. Don't get it confused, I view this from a human perspective. How many more resolutions have to be violated? How many more
innocent children have to be annihilated. Israel is a terror state, they're terrorists that terrorize. I testify, my television televised, I'm telling lies. This is not a war, it is systematic genocide. But whatever they try, Palestine will never die. Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for an answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine, long live Gaza. Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for an answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine, long live Gaza.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Low Key with Long Live Palestine. And so I just want to follow that up with a discussion that Ali Abu Nima of Electronic Intifada, who's had amazing commentary on Palestine over the years, really bring the truth out about what's been going on there for a very long time now. And this is the talk which he gave on Danny Haifong's YouTube channel, just after this whole, this recent conflict just this past month began, and he really outlined what brought it about and its context in the wider conflict in Palestine. So, you know, and he's just amazing. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR, listen to what Ali Abu Nima has to say.
I wanted to get you on, Ali, obviously, because the last 48 hours or so, just a hair under, have been incredibly eventful when it comes to Palestine and, of course, Israel's retaliation to Palestinian resistance that has been ongoing since the early hours of October 7th. Could you just begin, and I'll pull some photos and videos, images of what's been going on as you're speaking. But could you just begin by outlining what has happened here? Because I'm hearing and seeing things like Palestinian forces have enacted a casualty rate of 2-1. Usually it's the opposite. There's, you know, Palestinian resistance forces, Hamas, breaking through the fences in Gaza, taking back some land. There's all sorts of, you've probably been hearing the Western mainstream media talk a lot about kidnappings and all kinds of things like that. Kidnappings of major generals, of so-called civilians, settlers, I mean, on and on and on. So I'll pull up some images while you're talking, but please do, if you can, give an outline of what's been happening in this conflict as of right now.
We're witnessing something historic that people are stunned. I mean, people in Palestine, people across the Arab world, of course, people in Israel, absolutely stunned. Things have turned on their heads. And I actually, for the last 48 hours, have watched almost no US or Western media, partly to preserve my mental health, but mostly because it's not informative. So I don't know if people who are watching this primarily through Western media have any sense of the massive scale and transformative nature of what's happening, that Hamas, not just Hamas, but other Palestinian resistance groups, launched a major coordinated offensive, breaking out of the besieged, occupied Gaza Strip, occupying 24 Israeli colonies near Gaza, one as far as 22 kilometers away from Gaza, off Afakim. They seized several Israeli military bases and checkpoints. They killed Israeli soldiers inside military bases. They took over heavily fortified bases and took soldiers captive, including senior officers. They used weapons that nobody knew they had. They put out video showing what we can see now on the screen, them using paragliders or paramotors. They are using suicide drones, and they're using drones that are capable of dropping munitions, and they actually published videos of them destroying tanks and destroying automated machine gun nests using airdropped munitions. And they have done it with military skill and coordination that nobody knew they had, that was thought to, that was known to be a capability of, say, Hezbollah in Lebanon, but it wasn't known to be this level of capability from the Palestinian resistance. And at the same time, they utterly destroyed the myth of Israeli military prowess and competence and invincibility. And they exposed Israel's army as completely a shambles, as incompetent. Israeli intelligence, which has this legendary reputation that they're so good, completely had no awareness that this was coming. This has been compared with the surprise that Israel experienced exactly 50 years ago, almost to the day, the October 1973 war, when Egypt and Syria launched a surprise attack in order to liberate the occupied Sinai Peninsula and the occupied Golan Heights. And Egypt, the Egyptian forces succeeded in crossing the Suez Canal and in breaching the what was called the Bar-Lev line, after the Israeli general Haim Bar-Lev, which the Israelis believed was impregnable. And that was an utter shock, and it led eventually to the end of the political career of Golda Meir and a lot of repercussions. In a sense, this is even bigger, because this is the first time in history that any Arab force or any Palestinian force has taken the battle inside Israeli territory, because the Israeli military doctrine was always that wars should be conducted on its terms, on its timing, and outside its borders or its boundaries. Israel doesn't really have borders. This time it was Hamas that determined the time and the place and the manner. And now, as we're speaking, 48 hours or more, around 48 hours into the offensive, the Israelis have still not regained control of all the settlements around Gaza, and they've evacuated 75,000 settlers from the lands around Gaza. So it is a stunning achievement. It has stunned Palestinians. It has stunned Israelis. It has stunned the whole Arab world. And I think that, and it has really stunned the world. But I think if you're looking at it through the lens of Western media, or the lens of Western liberal thinking, you're not going to get, you may well miss the significance and just the incredible nature of what we're witnessing.
Yes, indeed. And I was just putting up a lot from, especially Richard Medhurst, who has been posting all over Twitter on his threads of just what are chaotic events, but are just incredible historically, just in terms of how rapidly things have deteriorated for Israeli forces, but also just how organized and how coordinated the Palestinian resistance has been. And I'm just wondering, Ali, and there's been a lot of theories. You mentioned some intelligence failures. There are some I'm hearing talking about, was this an inside job, a false flag? Others are saying, well, this has to do with a context that isn't really spoken about in terms of support for Palestinian resistance and just how strong it has been, and maybe waiting for the right moment to strike. I'm just wondering what your opinion is about how this happened in your estimation as you've been following these events.
Well, no, this wasn't an inside job. This was the Palestinian resistance that has been developing its capabilities under Israeli siege for many, many years by necessity and very skillfully and very secretively. They have been getting help. There is mutual aid among the regional resistance groups, particularly with Hezbollah in Lebanon. And it's not a secret that Iran supports the Palestinian resistance. Palestinians, as a colonized people struggling for their liberation, have a right to seek aid from anywhere they can get it. Just as Europeans, we just published an article by Joseph Massad on the Electronic Intifada, and he made the point that all the criticism that Palestinians get from Arab regimes and from Western governments and Western liberals about, oh, you take support from Iran. Well, it's not as if the Palestinians turn down support from other countries. Nobody else is offering the Palestinians material support for their liberation struggle. But you know, saying Palestinians shouldn't take support from Iran is to say that they have no right to resist and no right to defend themselves, and clearly they do. So Iran is certainly a factor, but the extent to which, you know, how they coordinate, how they develop weapons, these are all very closely guarded secrets. And anyone who tells you they know that is lying to you. I mean, there was a laughable article today in the Wall Street Journal, of all places, that says, oh, Iran helped plan the operation and it gave its approval in a meeting held in Beirut last week. It gave the go-ahead in a meeting, and this was confirmed to the Wall Street Journal by senior officials from Hamas and Hezbollah. And you actually read the article, it's just totally hilarious because, of course, they don't name any officials who said that. And yeah, it's really credible that Hamas and Hezbollah are going to spill their most closely held secrets to an American, rabidly anti-Iran, anti-resistance neocon rag. That's where they're going to go and choose to tell their secrets to. So it's just BS. But so one of the factors that I think Israel can't ignore, and its defense minister, Yoav Gallant, said this a few months ago, is that Israel is no longer in a position where it can decide to limit any military confrontation to one front. There is now the potential for a multi-front war, which involves not just Hamas in Gaza, but also the Northern Front with Hezbollah, and potentially Iran, and Syria. And it's always been thought that Hezbollah has tremendous capabilities, tremendous missile capabilities and fighting abilities, because Hezbollah defeated Israel in combat when Israel invaded Lebanon in 2006. And of course, before that, Hezbollah forced Israel out of Lebanon. Israel had been occupying southern Lebanon for 20 years until the year 2000, when the Israeli forces were forced to abandon southern Lebanon. Then they came back in 2006 and Hezbollah defeated them again. And after that, you had all this sort of self-doubt in Israel saying, you know, we have to learn the lessons and the IDF was not prepared and we have to do better. And this is the result, that they were beaten by Hamas, who is completely besieged in Gaza, surrounded on all sides. And so the question that must be on a lot of minds in Israel and in Washington and in among Israel's other sponsors and partners in crime is, if this is what Hamas can do from Gaza, what can Hezbollah do from Lebanon? And so now Israel is in a really difficult situation from its perspective, of course, where the Israeli people have just seen their vaunted legendary military completely fail to protect them, just collapse, the whole so-called Gaza division of the Israeli army just melted away. Its senior officers killed or captured. Its bases taken over by the Palestinian resistance and put on display on television. Just rows of abandoned tanks and armored vehicles, soldiers captured in their underwear and so on, or killed. We saw many images of Israeli soldiers killed. Their whole government and military echelon, who, you know, these tough guys who we're all about security, we're all about protection, caught completely with their pants down. And so Israel has to appease that rage and anger and fear by doing something big. And that's what they're already doing, which is bombing Gaza, just bombing civilian homes out of revenge, massacring entire families, what they always do, but they're now doing it even more. But they now have a situation where there is over at least 100, Hamas and Islamic Jihad is saying 130 Israeli prisoners of war and detainees in Gaza. So there's a limit to how wild Israel can go, even though it has a green light to go wild from Joe Biden, because of the fact that it's prisoners of war in Gaza and because of the risk that that Hezbollah could enter on the northern front. So this is a situation that really exposes Israel's weakness and failure and completely destroys its image as this plucky, powerful little Sparta that is just invincible. And people have seen that Israel can be defeated and was defeated. And as much as it may go in and murder people just in revenge in Gaza, which it is doing and will do, that will not erase the defeat.
Yes, and the major leaders of the Al-Qassam have said that Israel, the IDF, would be smart to take note that the estimations they have of hostages, of those who have been kidnapped, scattered across Gaza. Yeah,
I don't say kidnapped because they are prisoners of war and detainees. Unless we're willing to use, you know, the media, the human rights groups and the governments, unless they're willing to refer to the thousands of Palestinians abducted at gunpoint from their homes in night raids every night across the West Bank, held without charge or trial in Israel's dungeons. Nobody calls those abducted people. That, in fact, they call them by this nice, polite term, administrative detainees. So let's refer to them as Israeli prisoners of war and administrative detainees in Gaza, just to be fair and equal and consistent. But yes, having said that, you know, the clear thing to say, I mean, I just want to make this point, is that none of this was inevitable. Israel brought this on itself because the leaders of Hamas said that they tried through every possible mediator and every way to get Israel to agree to a prisoner exchange. There were already a couple of Israelis detained in Gaza and the bodies of several soldiers held by Hamas. And Israel just utterly refused. And they have increased the number of abductions in the West Bank to 20-year highs. So, and on the political front, Hamas has for years tried to pursue a political path following the model of the IRA and Northern Ireland, and they just found the door slammed in their face at every turn by Israel, by the United States, by the Europeans. And so, as Nelson Mandela said, Nelson Mandela wrote in his amazing book, The Long Walk to Freedom, it is the oppressor, not the oppressed, who determines the form of the struggle. If the oppressor uses violence, the oppressed have no choice but to respond with violence. And this is precisely the situation the Palestinian people are in. And there's just an utter lack of reflection and self-reflection among Israel and its allies who simply refuse to understand that. And the result has been not the Palestinians getting weaker as Israel has besieged Gaza, but the Palestinians and the regional resistance getting stronger and more confident and more capable. That has been the result of their total unwillingness to deal with the Palestinians as human beings, as people who deserve their rights, deserve their liberation, who are a people, an indigenous people on their land and who are attached to their land. Their utter contempt for the Palestinian people, their dehumanization of the Palestinian people, I think is a large part of this. Israel believed its own myths of technological and military, and I would add racial superiority. And that, to a great extent, led to the complacency in which they could not possibly believe that the Palestinians could mount such a sophisticated and sustained offensive that, it's also important to note, is widely and deeply supported by the Palestinian people. There was I'll just say this. There was sort of a TV presenter, some influencer from the United Arab Emirates, who posted this concern trolley comment about saying, oh, well, you know, has Hamas thought about how they are going to protect the people of Gaza from Israel's revenge? So, you know, this defeatist language which says you can't fight, you know, the Vietnamese should not fight for their liberation because the Americans are just going to carpet bomb them and napalm them, so they should surrender. That's the logic that's being put forward. And I was touched by one of the comments I read from a Palestinian woman in Gaza. She said, it's not the resistance that protects the people of Gaza. It's the people of Gaza who protect the resistance. And I thought that that was just such a neat encapsulation of the depth and the breadth of support that the resistance has among the Palestinian people, and indeed the people of the region. Of course, not the Arab tyrants and regimes that are slaves to the United States and Israel, but the people.
I pity the country, I pity the state, and the mind of a man who thrives on hate. Small are the lives of cheats and of liars, of bigoted news press, fascist town crier. Deception annoys me, deception destroys me. The Bill of Rights throws me in jails, they all know me. Frustrated are churchmen, the saving of soul men, the tinker, the tailor, the colonial governor. They pull and they palm me, they're seeking to draw me away from the roundness of the light. Civil servants, they thrive off my body. Their trip is with power, back bacon and welfare. Police, they arrest me. Materialists detest me. Pollution, it chokes me. Movies, they joke me. Politicians exploit me. City life that jades me. Hudson Bay fleets me. Hunting laws freak me. Government is bumbling. Revolution's rumbling. To be ruled in impunity is tradition continuity. I pity the country. I pity the state. And the mind of a man who thrives on hate.